Hey everyone, it's Abadesi, your host of Product Hunt Radio, where I'm joined by the founders, investors, and makers that are shaping the future of tech. Today, I chat with Saran Yitbarek, CEO and founder of Code Newbie and Codeland Conference. I've known Saran a while through the content she creates online. I find it really educational, highly relatable, and we covered a lot today. We chat about how she went from working as a journalist to becoming a software engineer, lessons on pivoting into tech, and also how to learn to code from scratch, including the failed attempts. We also talk about how to make the most of coding boot camps and land really good jobs afterwards. Finally, we touch on the software she uses to stay productive and connected with her team. But first, let's hear from our sponsors.
So I know that a lot of our listeners are managers at companies, and being a manager is super tough. You might spend a lot more time tracking projects through text threads, email chains, constant meetings, than actually getting your own work done. Monday.com is a team management platform that helps you plan, organize, and track the projects no matter what industry you're in. See who's doing what and the status of all your projects and tasks. The tool is super easy to use so your team can get started in minutes. Visit monday.com/producthunt today to get a 30-day free trial.
Hi, Saran. Thank you so much for joining us today on Product Hunt Radio. I've been a huge fan of yours, sort of following you online on Twitter, following the Code Newbies journey. I've read blog posts that you've done on platforms like People of Color in Tech. But maybe for people who aren't super familiar with your work, tell us a bit about, you know, who you are, where you're based, and what you're working on.
Sure, absolutely. So I am currently based in San Diego, California, but I'm actually moving back to the East Coast, back to the New York City, New Jersey area soon, in a couple of months, actually. Super excited to be back on the East Coast. I'm super pumped. It's just so much energy and so much life and people hustling and bustling and trying to get things done. I'm excited to like be in that environment again, you know? And then as far as my work, I am the CEO founder of Code Newbie. We are a community of people who are learning to code and programmers, and we are the most supportive community. And our whole goal is to create content and projects that help you become the best developer you can and to help you feel comfortable and supported in your coding journey. And so we do that a couple ways. We have two podcasts. We have the BaseCS podcast, where myself and my co-host Vaidehi Joshi, we teach computer science in 20-minute episodes. We have our Code Newbie podcast, which is me interviewing all kinds of people, from folks who are just getting started all the way up to like the CTO of Microsoft. And that is me doing interviews of people on their coding journey and trying to get some really good stories and lessons and advice and that whole thing. And then we also produce a conference called Codeland, which is happening July 22nd in New York City. And that is all about bringing the stuff that we're doing online and bringing that to life and really getting a chance to celebrate the wonderful world of coding. So that is all about getting people to talk not just about the technical tools, but what they're using the tools to do and what they're using it for. So how are they creating, you know, funny satire apps, satirical apps? How are they using it?
Cool.
Yeah, we have a really great opening talk from a woman who does this app called Equitable. And the idea behind the app is, you know how there's like, you know, a huge pay gap between men and women and people of color and women of color. And so she basically created an app that you can use when you go out with someone who is not like you. And based on your demographics, you share a certain part of the bill. So if I'm amazing. Going out with, yeah, it's amazing. What is it? I think it's like 66 cents to the dollar of like women of color or black women specifically to white men. So if I go out with a white man, then I only have to pay, you know, my share and he gets to pay a little bit more.
So this it's is like, awesome. It's this amazing, is going to transform right? the dating world.
Yeah. It's amazing. And it's this brilliant, funny way of talking about something that's actually a really deep and big problem. And she used technology to do that and to get her point across. So highlighting stories like that of people who are doing amazing things to solve problems and talk about real issues using the power of code.
Ah, I love that. I love this focus on stories. That's something we care a lot about at Product Hunt. You know, we recently launched Maker Stories. And really, Product Hunt Radio is all about sort of going beyond that public profile of the people shaping the future of tech and getting to know more about their story and things that, you know, at a first glance, you may not have known or may not have understood. So I definitely want to come back to talking more about Codeland and Code Newbie, but I'd love to rewind a little bit and hear more about your story and specifically
your journey into tech. So is software engineering something that you dreamed about when you were a child?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I didn't even know what that was. My experience with, you know, we had a personal computer. We had a computer in our home since I was like 9 years old. So I had like relatively early exposure to technology. But frankly, I didn't know what to do with it. You know, I had this big machine and I would like, you know, check my email as if anyone is emailing me, you know, at like 9 years old. And I would play Oregon Trail because I think it like It like came with a computer and I was like, I guess this is what you use machines for. Like you just play Oregon Trail. So I had no idea, you know, about the world of technology, the world of software engineering. And it's actually interesting because my husband, you know, we've been together for 10 years now, married for four. And since we met, he's in tech, he's been in tech since he was like 2 years old. Like he, you know, he's one of those people that's been like a huge techie for a very long time, always had the latest gadgets. And even while we were dating, it never occurred to me that I could do that. You know, for some reason, it never translated. And he was very exciting, very, you know, he shared all of his tech with me and all that. He was like the first person to show me an iPhone. You know what I mean? Like he's very sharing, but it still never got from, oh, that's his thing to, oh, maybe that could be my thing. Like that never happened. And it wasn't until maybe like 2 years after we started dating that I read the Steve Jobs book and the Walter Isaacson book. And I said, oh, tech can be artistic and designy and, you know, like really human. And a lot of things that I connected with, I've always been like a liberal arts, you know, type of kid. And I loved media and communication and creating beautiful things and telling stories. And so that was the first time tech was presented as a tool for doing that sort of stuff, you know, that category of things that I didn't think tech was really involved in. And that was when I finally went, oh, maybe I can do tech. Like maybe there's a place for me and maybe this is something I want to explore. So that's how it started for me. It started when I was graduated from college, maybe a year out of school, and I read that Steve Jobs book.
That's incredible. I relate to that experience because I also never considered tech as a career option, even though I was immersed in technology. I mean, like you know, yeah. I played computer games, I had consoles at home, but I just never thought about, you know, the roles within technology or what it would be like. I guess I just never like went past like that tangible thing that I played with until, you know, I saw that film, The Social Network, Aaron Sorkin. And that's when I was like, hello, this is a technology I've never seen before.
Yeah.
And I just wonder like, you know, why that is. Like maybe like reflecting now, do you think there's like something that tech can do better, whether that's tech leaders or like as an industry to make it more obvious and appealing to people that there are career options here?
Yeah, I think there are two things. I think number one, if I had seen more people who looked like me doing it, I think that idea would have been planted in my mind. Like I would have looked at someone and went to like, oh, they can do it. You know, maybe I can do it. If I saw, you know, more Black women or just people of color or just more women in general who were leaders and who were on stage. I remember the first time, what is her name? Boz, the woman who was at Beats.
And then, John.
Yes, thank you. I was like, what is her name? When she was on stage, yeah, she was on stage at WWDC some years ago, a couple years ago, and she was the first woman of color that I'd seen on the, you know, on the Apple stage, and I lost my mind. I was so excited. I was like, oh my God, like, we made it. I felt so proud and so excited. And it was just such an amazing moment. And I feel like if that moment had, for me, had come 10 years ago, if it had come, you know, in high school, in college, I think it would have been a different story. And I think the other thing is the application of tech. Like when I think about technology, at least until, you know, until I got into it, I saw it as a tool for sciencey things or a tool like research and that kind of thing, and like AI and robots and things I didn't really understand. Or I saw it as a tool for like gaming. And I've never been a gamer. That's just never been my thing. And so those are the two things I'm just not interested in. Like I'm not interested in robots, don't care about robots, and I don't care about video games. So, you know, there kind of wasn't anything about it that pulled me to it. And it wasn't until the Steve Jobs book that I went, oh, there's like design and there's like aesthetic and there's storytelling and there are all these other things I could relate to. So I think the application of technology was something that was a bit lacking and maybe a little bit one-dimensional. And since then, I think has been a lot broader over the years.
Application of technology as a way to expand perceptions and horizons. Yes. I love that. I think that's also a really good segue into how you then started on your coding journey. So in the product and community, tens of thousands of people are learning how to code or trying to upskill on an existing language they're familiar with, or they're trying to experiment and like learn something new. I recently saw someone write a maker goal to become a data scientist, which was then followed up by another goal of learn Python.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you, you read the Steve Jobs book and you're like, okay, I can create with software. I can, you know, build with code. What do you do next? How do you actually start learning those skills?
Yeah. So before I got to that point, my idea when I finished the book was I want to be in tech. And I don't really know what that means. I knew I wanted to be a part of this world, but I didn't know that coding was the thing I wanted to do. I just knew that I wanted to be in that space. And so I started researching a bunch of startups and tech startups and followed a bunch of companies and researched and read a bunch of other books. And over time, I ended up cold emailing a bunch of startup CEOs in New York City and
Yeah.
And then one of those coffees turned into an internship, and that internship turned into a job. And so
that from cold outreach.
Yeah. Just cold emailing will get you very far in life.
What did you say in your email?
I don't remember. I think it was something like it's at the time I was working in journalism and the company was a content marketing company and they were kind of based in journalism. And so I think I said something like, you know, I'm currently a journalist. I'm really excited about technology. I'd love to see if there's a way that I can, you know, talk to you and see what, you know, what your startup is like and see if there's some way I can contribute. I think it's something like very generic like that. But I tried to use my journalism angle as a way for being like, I'm interesting. Please pay attention to me, you know. That worked out really well. And so once I got that job, I realized very quickly that because I wasn't technical, I wasn't on the product team, that my value was relatively low, to be very honest. You know, like the rock stars on any tech, any startup team is usually the engineering team. And so I felt very much like I couldn't make the impact that I wanted to make, and I couldn't contribute the way that I wanted to contribute because I didn't have a technical background. And I worked at a couple startups, and every time I kept bumping up against this issue of not being technical. And eventually, I think after 2 years of working in startups, I said to myself, all right, I think I need to just pause, invest in my own skills, and figure out what this coding world is all about. And, you know, from there, I think I'll be able to have the impact in the career that I want.
That's awesome. So it was actually starting off your tech career in non-technical roles and then kind of deciding, actually, I want to have the technical expertise. So at that juncture, were you thinking of like working on learning coding full time? Were you thinking that you might try to do it in between work? How did you decide to actually transition into the technical side?
So I tried to learn how to code twice. So the first time I learned, I did it like after work. I took the intro to programming course on MIT OpenCourseWare, which is a very hard course, very terrible course. I do not recommend it if you are using it to learn how to code for the first time. Maybe if you're learning like a new language or if you're comfortable with, you know, with coding, like maybe, but not as a total newbie. I do not recommend it. But it was a really hard course. It was really hard for me to understand what anyone was doing, what they were talking about. And I just kind of told myself, well, I guess coding isn't for me. You know, like maybe my brain just doesn't work that way. Like it was really that difficult and just really, really hard to understand even the way that I should study for. You know, I'm used to studying with flashcards and highlighters and textbooks and taking like lots of notes. And that's not how you learn how to code. And so even my tool set was wrong, you know, in terms of how I approached it. And so after trying, you know, I said, all right, I'm just going to go back to my non-technical role. And then after another, I think it was another year, maybe 2 years after that, where I said, okay, let's try this one more time. But this time we're going to use different resources. So that's when I used Code Academy, Treehouse, Code School, the types of products that are made for completely new people and people who like actually know nothing, like what is a text editor? What is a command line? You know, and it was made for people like me. And that made it so much easier, so much more just doable. And it just felt so much more accessible to me. And so when I found those resources, I said to myself, I want to do this full time. I'm going to give myself a month to see if I like it. And I'm not allowed to quit until that month is over. And so the first time I tried it, you know, I did it for a couple, maybe like a week or two. And I was like, this isn't for me. And so this time I said to myself, it's going to be hard. It's going to suck. But let's just give it a month and we'll see if it sucks less at the end of that month. And it did. It sucked less. So I continued and I went about my coding journey.
That's amazing. Did you try to do anything like 100 days of code or like really try to stick to a regime where you're like, okay, at least every day I'm doing something coding related, even after that 30-day period?
No. So at that time, 100 Days of Coding wasn't a thing yet. That came out like, I think maybe a couple years later. So at that point, after the month was over, I said, okay, I'm committed to this. Now I have to figure out, do I keep learning on my own? Do I go back to school and get a CS degree? Do I do a boot camp? Do I learn online? Like, what are the different options? And that's the great thing about learning to code, especially nowadays, is there's so many options. There's so many ways that you can do it. And I said to myself, you know, I think I want to do a boot camp. I think I want to be in a classroom. I want a teacher. I want some TAs. I want some place where I can raise my hand and ask a million questions. And that's just the scenario. That's the environment where I personally learn best. And so I said to myself, that's what I want to do. And then I started researching boot camps. And the one I ended up getting into and went to was called the Flatiron School. And they had this pre-work. I don't know if they still have it, but it's this pre-work, which is, I think it's about a month long, like 80 hours or something. Program where you can do it on your own. So that's what I used to do that first month of learning. I found that pre-work and I went through that curriculum. Yeah. And then afterwards, I kind of kept going on that and kept expanding and using it to just continue learning until the program started. I actually ended up doing that pre-work, I think two or three times before I actually got started in bootcamp, just to make sure I was like drilling in everything and really understood all the parts of it.
Yes. I think pre-work is like pretty common model and
yeah,
also very handy. I mean, there was a time when I was like, yeah, I'm going to learn Rails and like JavaScript, let's go. And I remember like applying for a competition to win a spot at a coding school here in London. And, you know, we were also given pre-work. And that's when I learned about like, oh, you need to like set up an environment on your laptop. You can't just like open up a browser and just start hacking away and coding.
So that was really enlightening.
So thinking about, I guess, like coming into the coding journey, having already had real life experience in tech startups, did that make it any less intimidating than if you were, let's say, someone who had never worked in tech or maybe had just graduated but didn't do something technical and then tried to learn how to code or learn in a bootcamp?
I'm not sure. That's a really good question. I assume that there was some level of, I don't think it was about comfort or intimidation. I think it was more of like having a very clear goal, you know, because I'd worked next to the engineers. I knew what their job, I didn't know what they were doing, but I knew what their job looked like. You know, I could see all the hieroglyphics on the screen that, you know, was code. So I could appreciate the end goal. And I could say like, I know that I want to be a developer. And I had a clear understanding of the value of that and of, you know, what that actually meant after the bootcamp was over. So because of that, I think it was a little bit more motivating because I had that clear goal and that picture of success at the end of the bootcamp.
That's awesome. So what do you think has changed about like the coding bootcamp scene since you learned then up until now? Because we already mentioned how 100 Days of Code wasn't even a thing then. Now we have like apps like Grasshopper where you can learn JavaScript. We've got things like Lambda School where you don't even need to pay up front to go. How have you seen the life of being a code newbie and trying to get into engineering change? And do you think, you know, it's set how it is now, or do you still expect this landscape to change even more going forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that there are way more options today than I think there have ever been in terms of learning how to code. I think there are also different models. What is interesting about Lambda School is not just the fact that you don't have to pay up front, because there have been other boot camps where that was the case as well. It's also the fact that their programs are pretty long. I think it's like, what is it, like a year, 9 months to 20 months, depending on if you do it part-time to full-time. So I think that there is kind of this deeper understanding of what it really takes to learn how to code and what it really takes to be job ready. And I think that some of the programs are a little bit longer, they're a little bit more in depth. They're not trying to cover all the things, they're trying to cover the fundamental things. So I think there's a maturity that's been happening in the learn to code space where we have a better understanding of what companies are actually looking for, what they're willing to pay, and it's becoming a little more grown up.
I like that. I kind of wanted like touch on something that you brought up there, which is maybe like quite a controversial topic because people's experiences seem to vary so much and there isn't a huge amount of transparency around it. But it's about employability as an engineer after boot camps. So, I mean, you know, we've already mentioned Lambda School and they're often retweeting stories of people who've, you know, got amazing offers, etc. But the reality is there are also a number of people that I've seen on social media and talking about it in communities that I'm in who have completed a boot camp, but have struggled to get a job, or at least it's taken them like a number more months than they had expected to, given the demand. Why do you think it sometimes feels like a mixed bag as an observer in terms of the people that sort of really luck out with a great offer after boot camp and people who kind of take a while to find their feet.
Yeah, I think that there are a couple of factors. I think the first is expectations after boot camp. So when I got into the Flatiron School and graduated, they did help with the career stuff. They had a really great science fair where they had a bunch of employers come out and, you know, get to know the students, and we got to show off our projects. But even with that support, I had the understanding that it's my job to get a job. Like, it's not the school's responsibility to get me a job. Like, I knew that it was kind of on me, and I took that responsibility very seriously. And so I set up my expectations accordingly. I think that a lot of people go into boot camp kind of assuming that the boot camp itself is going to get them a job. And that might be because of the stories they've heard. That might be, frankly, because of false advertising from the boot camp itself. But I think there is this expectation oftentimes that if I go and graduate, I'm going to automatically get a job without really having to go through the job search. And so if you go into it, that mindset, it's going to be frustrating if it takes a couple months to land that first job. So I think expectations is one thing. I think the other thing is that getting a job and transitioning into a new career is just really hard. And I think it's a lot harder than we've been telling people that it is. I think that, you know, if you think about going from, let's say, an English teacher all the way to a developer, that's a really big jump. That's a huge jump. So it makes sense that it would take 3 months to get that job. It might may even make sense that it'll take 6 months to get that job, just because the leap itself is just a really big leap. So I think that part of it is just we've done, frankly, a really terrible job of being realistic of how big that jump is. Because it sounds really cool to say, like, you know, in 30 days, you're going to get this brand new, shiny, amazing job that pays $100,000. Like, that sounds good. That tells a really good story. But I think the reality is that switching careers is really, really tough, and it takes a while. And just understanding that and appreciating that and just being really honest as an industry is really important. And I think the other part is, like, your network is everything. Your network is absolutely everything. And so when you're hearing the success stories, the question that I would like to ask is, how did that person actually get that job? You know, did they have, you know, like, did they have a friend? Are they located in San Francisco where everyone's hiring as many developers as possible? Are they located in a tech, you know, hotspot? Do they already work at a tech company and now they're just transitioning to a new role instead of a new company? You know what I mean? Like, there's so many other variables that go into it that before I say, you know, this person got a job in a month getting paid $100,000, therefore I expect to get that, I would try at least to dig a little bit deeper, maybe ask some questions that figure out, but how do they really get it? Who do they already know? You know, were they switching companies? Are they in a really big tech city? Because all those things will make it a lot easier and will factor into how quickly you can get a job. And that's the kind of thing where, like, cold emailing is really helpful. So, you know, a lot of boot camps, frankly, are not necessarily going to share that data, and they're not going to, you know, give you, like, I think they do a pretty decent job of sharing general job reports, but they're not going to go into the detail that you probably want. And so that's a good opportunity to reach out to folks that you read about and say, like, hey, can I talk to you for 15 minutes about how you got your job? You know, things like that, I think, would be really helpful in getting to the core data that you need to decide what your expectations should be.
That's amazing. I think that idea of, like, managing expectations and having realistic expectations is the solution to so many of life's problems.
Yes,
and
I agree.
Particularly ones related to careers, just because no matter how hard you work and no matter, you know, whatever you put into it, there are so many other decision makers involved in the process that you have no control over. And I think if one can remember that, then hopefully they won't despair too much if things are taking a lot longer than planned. Another thing that you touched on was networks. And I think we don't like to talk about this very much in technology, maybe because it makes us feel bad or makes us feel more exclusive than we would like to come across. But networks are extremely powerful when it comes to recruitment in tech. And tech isn't the only industry, you know, it's everywhere. It's like an evolution of nepotism in some ways. And I think that's why we see such a growth, both in participation and engagement in communities like Code Newbie, like Product Hunt, like Makers, because it's such a barrier-free way to immediately expand your network and maximize, you know, the opportunities that are available to you, but also, like, ways that you can learn and, you know, people that you can just connect with. So I guess this is quite a good time to talk about Code Newbie, because I'm curious, you know, at what point did you decide, okay, I have an idea here, I'm going to launch this. I want to know, like, how that happened and what the process was to go from idea to reality.
Yeah, absolutely. So this happened while I was actually in boot camp. You know, I kept saying to myself, this is a really great opportunity for me. I have this amazing community of people who are also learning to code, who are supportive and just really, you know, amazing to be around. But it's pretty expensive to get that type of community, especially back then where free code camp, I don't think was a thing yet. Dev 2 wasn't a thing yet. And so there really weren't a lot of places where you could find other people who are willing to help you and willing to support you on your coding journey. And so I was trying to figure out, how do you provide that community without having to spend thousands of dollars on a bootcamp? And so when I was looking through the options, Twitter chats were a really great way to foster community. And were a really great way to start conversations and really help people who are learning to code. And so I said to myself, we should do a Twitter chat, and it'll be called Code Newbie. Yeah, it'll be the hashtag Code Newbie. And how a Twitter chat works is that you pick a day and time, you pick a hashtag, and then you sign on to Twitter at that time. And using that hashtag, someone usually moderates. They'll ask questions and the community will answer, chime in, and talk to each other. So we might have a question, for example, that says, you know, your dream tech job or your dream coding job. And the questions might be, you know, how would you describe your dream coding job in 3 words? And then everyone pitches in and shares their answer using the hashtag. So it's a way to organize conversations on Twitter, and it does a pretty good job. It doesn't get too hectic. And so that was kind of how it got started, was me asking, how do we create a community without having to spend, you know, $10,000, $12,000 and without having to quit your job? And so,
right, yeah. That's amazing. At what point did you realize that? Because this is a question that we get like asked a lot in the community and, you know, ask each other. I guess there's no hard and fast rule or template. But at what point did you realize you were really getting traction and there was really like a need for this? And it wasn't just you that wanted to have these conversations. It wasn't just you that wanted to like get this information from other peers. There was more than that. And you're like, oh my gosh, it's like, this is a platform. This has legs. Was there ever like a light bulb moment where you're like, I'm on to something now?
Yeah, there were two moments. So the first is, I think it was maybe 5 to 6 months after we started doing the Twitter chats. All of a sudden, I didn't need to keep retweeting or getting people to retweet about the Twitter chat. People just kind of showed up. So we had like taught people and this behavior that they're going to show up on Wednesday nights at 6 p.m. Pacific time, 9 p.m. Eastern time, and they're going to come and talk about code. And so we'd, you know, help develop that habit for people, and they showed up on their own without us having to do a lot of like marketing and retweeting and all that. So that was the first sign. I said, okay, people really want this and they need this and they're excited to show up and talk with us. The other moment was, I think it was maybe a year after we started doing the chats, we had started doing the podcast. And I think a couple months into the podcast, a company reached out and said, hey, I'll give you $200 if you run an ad on your show. And I said, holy crap, I can make money from this. That's insane. And so that was the moment where I said, oh, not only can this be like a fun side project, but it might also be like a sustainable project as well.
That's amazing. That's pretty cool because you actually had inbound communication to help you validate your product.
Yeah,
whereas
exactly.
Most makers are out there going, do you want to buy this? How much would you pay for this? Pay me anything for this. So that's quite unusual, but still very cool. And yeah, I mean, we're obviously huge fans of community over at Product Hunt. So I think it makes sense and I think that's great.
If you are in charge of your startup's financials, you already know how frustrating insurance can be. Through the Embroker Startup Program, you can save an average of 20% on directors and officers, employment practice liability, errors and omissions, and cyber insurance custom built for startups. Go from application to coverage in minutes, not weeks. Embroker has raised more than $42 million to help make insurance work better for startups and currently works at over 1,000 VC-backed companies. Check out the Embroker Startup Program at emberoker.com/startup to see how you can improve coverage and save an average of 20% today.
Tell me then about Codeland and at what stage in the journey Codeland came to fruition.
Yeah, so we've been doing Codeland for, this will be the 3rd year, so we've done it for 2 years. And Codeland is something I'm super, super pumped about because I go to a lot of conferences, I speak at a lot of conferences, and a lot of times I'm kind of taking notes on things I like about the conference, things I don't like about the conference. And ever since the first conference I went to, which is RailsConf, I said to myself, man, it'd be really cool if I could do a conference like this, but for newbies, catered specifically to newbies. And so I always said to myself, at one point, I'm going to do it. I don't know when. I don't know how. I've never done a conference before, but I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to do it. And so I think it was a couple years after saying that, I was able to finally do my first conference. It's CoLAN. It's amazing. It's a day of talks and workshops, and it is geared towards people who are kind of fall in three buckets. So the first is people who are just learning about what code is, and they're trying to figure out how to learn, to try and navigate that space. The second group are for people who have, you know, invested in their education, and they're either in the middle of a boot camp, they're about to do a boot camp, or they're looking for a job. So they're like right in the middle of their journey. And then we have folks who are a little bit more experienced, like generally about 2 years or so of experience, maybe under 2 years, who are still new to coding, but they're professional, like they're already working and they already have jobs in the technical world. And so it's just a really great way for people to come together. And this year, we're actually doing it even bigger. We're going to be at Skirball, which is at NYU. And it's this big, beautiful theater where they have professional like comedians and recordings and productions. So yeah, I'm super excited about it.
This is awesome. I was like looking at the list of speakers earlier and I was like, I follow her on Twitter. I follow him on Twitter. I follow him on Twitter. And this That's is awesome. So cool. So I have like a question I'd love to ask. I get asked this by my mentees and friends all the time. And truthfully, I suffer from it as well. Like, how does one make the most of a conference? And this is especially if one is maybe like a bit introvert or maybe ambivert or maybe a bit shy or maybe, you know, you've seen on the attendees list all these people that you've seen on social media but never actually spoken to. What advice can you give folks that want to go and make the most of it and really maximize this opportunity, but maybe just have a bit of apprehension when it comes to conferences? Because they're not, you know, not that many people are actually like super confident at, you know, real life cold intros and stuff like that.
Yeah, I love that question. I think that conferences are really interesting because there's so much potential. There's so many opportunities at conferences to, you know, meet people and hear about ideas and all that, but they can also be really exhausting. I'm a huge extrovert, and by the end of a conference, I'm tired. Like, I want to like go back to my hotel room and like not talk to, especially if I'm speaking, I want to like not talk to anyone for 8 hours. So like I completely like it can be a lot. It can be very intense. So a couple things. Number one is to tweet about it. So usually the conference will have a hashtag or they'll have a Twitter handle. So the easiest thing to do is just use that Twitter handle, use that hashtag to say, hey, I'm going to be at, you know, RubyConf. If anyone wants to get coffee, come DM me, right? So something really simple like that, putting it out into the world is good. I've also seen people add it to their username on Twitter. So instead of my username just being Saran, it'll be Saran at RubyConf. Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So that way anybody who comes across my handle can see like, oh, she's at RubyConf. Maybe she wants to like hang out. So I think like using social media, using Twitter is a really great way to start that. I think the other thing is to like go up to speakers. Like speakers are really like, we love talking to people. That's why we're speakers. and so don't be shy. Like feel free to come up to folks and say like, hi, I'm so-and-so, loved what you're doing. And what will often happen is not only will you meet the speaker, which, you know, hopefully is fun and you like the speaker, but also you'll meet the other people who are in line to talk to that speaker, which is like interesting. So like, wow, especially if there's a big crowd, while you're waiting, you can always turn to the next person and go like, hey, you know, didn't you love that talk? Wasn't it really fun? You know what I mean? Like it becomes a really easy conversation starter. I think the other opportunity is at the lunch table. So usually at conferences, there are these big round tables and, you know, you kind of have to, you have to sit with strangers, you know? So instead of finding that one empty table, go to a table where there are already people and sit next to someone and just reach out and say like, hey, I'm Saran. What do you think of the conference so far? You know, what talks did you go to? You know what I mean? Like there are so many, who's your favorite speaker? There's so many easy talking points at a conference because you're sharing this experience together. So I think between the three of those, there are some good opportunities to find people and to start networking.
That's awesome. I love those tips. Funnily enough, I have actually used some of those things. And it's true. When I attended my very first AfroTech in SF last year, they had their own app, which I must say was like really, really helpful because everyone's kind of in the same boat. Like, hey, I'm on my own here. Anyone around? Also using the hashtag was really powerful. I want to kind of flip the tables a bit. A lot of the advice and perspectives we've been sharing are very much like on an individual level. So maybe like individual contributors who are building their careers or trying to break into their perfect role. I want to share some perspectives for the leaders now. So the founders who are listening, the CEOs, the people who are hiring. I guess the first thing I'd say is like, how can something like CoLAN and Code Newbie help them to ensure they're always getting the best talent and also that they're always giving the best support to their engineering teams?
Yeah. So one of the things that I really love about the Twitter chats is if you really think about it, they're almost like weekly customer interviews, you know, because you ask people, like, for example, the example I gave earlier, what is your dream tech job, right? There's a lot of really great information there that as an employer, I can look at and go, oh, wow, maternity leave is super important to these people. You know, mental health days are super important. You know, oh, people actually really don't like the unlimited vacation day policy. Do you know what I mean? Like, because the community is very vocal and very eager to share what they're experiencing, what they've been through, what they think, it is a really, really great environment for people to just listen. Like, I know a lot of folks who don't participate in the Twitter chats, but they hang out and they just listen and they pay attention and they take notes. And there's a lot of really good information where our community is literally telling you what we need from employers, from the industry, from technology. And it's a really great way to just listen and learn.
I love that. That's awesome. I would also like to see, I mean, I don't know if you guys offer that, like, for like companies to buy participants tickets for them, but I wouldn't have been able to go to AfroTech without that. And I would love to see like more companies just kind of like batch buying tickets to events and just like offering that as a perk with like, you know, like no strings attached beyond this is like an investment in your career capital and personal development, because it was like so nice to go. I mean, I did a few social media posts, but like mostly it was just cool to meet people in the community and meet people in real life who I'd only ever seen online.
Absolutely.
So on a personal level, I'd love to know like the role that community plays in your life. That might be like online communities or like maybe not even like the ones that you run or manage, but just like other ones that you enjoy that you're a part of. It could be communities that are offline. But I just love to know, like, you know, as on a personal level, you know, you're a founder that has like a number of different projects going on. I'm sure there are many times where your life is quite stressful. What role does community play in helping you stay productive and moving forward with all your projects?
Yeah. So it's interesting because as the person who manages a community, you would think that I had a community. but to be totally honest, I kind of don't. That's one thing that I would love to cultivate. And something that I've been actually recently working on cultivating is trying to get together a group of community managers and kind of creating our own community, like our own, you know, group of folks to support and help each other. But for me, what I lean on is more of peers and people who are a little bit ahead of me who I can learn from. So there are other podcasts, for example, who I know personally, who have been really open with sharing, you know, their numbers, their stats, who were really helpful in giving me advice. There are people in the speaker circuit that I can reach out to and say like, hey, you know, how is, you know, is there a speaking gig coming up? Are there, you know, is there a conference you're really excited about? So those are the kinds of things that have been really helpful to me, is building up my kind of personal little peer group, I guess is maybe the better word for it, where I know I can reach out to people and get help.
That's awesome. I love that. So let's go on to tech in terms of software, hardware, those kinds of things. What are the tools that you use to stay organized?
Yeah, I love this question. I love talking about productivity tools.
great.
So for me, it is like 90% of how I get anything done is through my calendar. I love my calendar so much. I've been, for the last couple months, I think, I've been using it as my to-do list as well.
So
if I need to do anything, it goes on the calendar. If it's not on the calendar, then I'm just not going to do it, because I'm very bad at maintaining. So what I used to do is I used to have a separate, usually like a pen and paper, piece of paper, where I would jot down my to-do list. I'd cross it off as I go. And I realized that I just kept getting out of sync between that and my events and meetings and stuff. And I would always like underestimate how long things would take. And it just wasn't a good way to keep track of everything. So now what I do is anytime someone gives me a task, I pull up my calendar and I have a separate calendar just called tasks, and I will give myself blocks of time to do any particular task. And so what ends up happening, which I love, is that I end up having a timesheet for myself of exactly what I'm doing every single hour of the day of my waking hours. Yeah. And at the end of the month, I tally them up and I make a spreadsheet and I can see exactly how I'm using my time. And I can see, you know, for example, I might say, man, it really feels like I spent a lot of time doing Codeland this month and I didn't mean to spend that much time. Where did that time go? And I can look back and I can see that information. Or the opposite, right? I can say, I thought I was spending a lot of time on the podcast, but it turns out, according to my timesheet, I only spent like a couple hours. Why did it feel like I spent more hours? So it gives me a lot of really good data to help me monitor my own productivity and to help me adjust and improve and use new strategies as it is available to me.
That's amazing. Is there like a specific calendar that you like most?
Good, just Google Calendar.
Oh, wow. Okay, nice. I like that. Keep it simple. So you've got the calendar link to your email. Obviously, that's the one that we use, but you've now created a secondary tasks exclusive calendar to track everything.
Yep. And there are two categories. There's work, just like, you know, Code Newbie, just general work. And then there is kind of personal time. So I also track, like, did I eat dinner? Did I go exercise? Did I take a nap? Did I watch the NBA finals? Like, wow. whatever tasks. So I really have like a great documentation system of like what I do every part of the week. It was actually really interesting because I did it. One of my goals for 2019 was I wanted to work less. I wanted to work closer to 40 hours a week and to just take mental health days and to, just to like practice self-care. And so I was really pleased to find out that like I'm reaching my goals. Like the data shows that I average about 40 hours a week doing all the work that I do. And I was really happy to see that like it's working. You know, I'm actually like when I get too tired, I stop. When I'm hungry, I eat. You know what I mean? Just like really basic things like that. And so I have the data to back it up. So yeah.
That's so good. I feel like that's like an extremely diligent way to kind of like force yourself to be less of a workaholic. Like,
yeah.
You're like, I have to force myself by actually analyzing every minute of time. But hey, if that works, that's awesome. No, I love that. I'm a slave to my calendar too, but only in the sense that if it's not in there, I will forget it because I sort of use it as a mental crutch. So, you know, if I don't see it in my calendar, I'm like, woohoo, I've got a free hour. I'll like run to a yoga class or like do something. And then meanwhile, I'll get an email like, hello, are you coming? And I'm like, oh, sorry, it wasn't in my calendar. Okay, cool. So nice. So now we know how Seransi is like organized. What else do you depend on as you get through the day? Like, are there project management tools, software tools?
Yeah. So we definitely use Trello to keep track of our editorial calendar for all of our podcast stuff. So we use that to see, you know, who have we pre-interviewed? Who did we send a mic to? When did we book an interview? When do we record? When have they edited? So we use Trello to just stay organized as a team. Also use Google Drive to keep track of like minutes and documentation and any kind of like notes and stuff we need to take as a team. And then we use Slack for our primary means of communication. So I don't like email. I get too much email. And so Slack is a really great way to kind of clean up my inbox or like stay out of my inbox and to get stuff done in real time. So yeah, those are the main tools.
Okay, cool. And then I'm curious, like, what about tech at home? So we've had like an interesting mix amongst guests. Like I always like to ask people, you know, like, do you have a smart home? Because I feel like it tells me a lot about their stance on privacy.
Yeah.
And then what they think about that. So I'm going to ask you.
Oh yeah.
Tell me, do you have
understand how anyone has a home device. Like it doesn't make, I am shocked and appalled. I'm so glad you asked this question because I've never had a platform to be able to vocalize this. And now I do. I am shocked and appalled at how everyone has a freaking Google Home or what's the Amazon one called? The Alexa. Like I cannot believe that everyone has this thing. Like it is literally a listening device in your home. Like they hear everything. Like I cannot believe they got away with it. I can't believe they convinced people that this is totally normal. So no, I do not have a home device. I don't plan on getting one. I think they are sneaky and I think they're only going to be used to invade our privacy. And I don't know how anyone is okay with it.
I'm very similar to you. For me, the ROI is just not there. Like,
yeah.
I'm fine, like, getting up to press play to, have a song on my speaker typing in a search query into my app.
But it's so minimal. Like, I don't understand. Like, just to be able to say, like, hey, you know, Alexa, change the station. Like, you're giving up your privacy and having a listening device just to do that. Like, it just, oh, my God. It upsets me.
I feel that some people are just like happy to pay that price. They're like, nah, my lives aren't that interesting or I don't care. But I think I've read too much sci-fi to like not like project the potentially sinister consequences about it.
Okay, there is never a benefit to it. Like there's never an upside to giving up your privacy. Do you know what I mean? Like there's not like there are like the upside compared to the downside is just so like the downside is absolutely evil and terrible. And the upside is like slight convenience, you know, like it just, the math just doesn't add up for me.
Space travel. It's apparently on the horizon. It's on the cards. Is this something that interests you? Are you going to be an early adopter on interplanetary life?
I could not care less
about
space travel. Like it, like I can appreciate that it is, you know, really complicated and really hard and just like as a, you know, technological feat, it like I can appreciate it, But like the idea of going to space, I think, is like the scariest thing ever. Like, I don't want to be in space. I have a home. Do you know what I mean? Like, I have a place I like. It's got oxygen. It's got water. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I have no interest in exploring some other planet that may or like that. There's just no. That sounds horrible. It sounds scary. It sounds very risky. And you know, I get why people are excited by it, but I also like don't really get why people are excited about it. So no, definitely not interested.
I'm just like, have you seen The Martian? I'm just going to wait for like the Oculus Rift AR version of that, because that'll be fine with me.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. Finally, are there any apps that you would love to delete off your phone but cannot because like you're too addicted to them, or, you know, the things which are just like a bit fun and a bit silly or like time consuming in some other possibly unproductive way, but amusing and entertaining way? I'll give you an example. I have TikTok on my phone. No shade to TikTok. Obviously, it's an awesome app, but it's like similar to Instagram. I just find myself on it when I should probably be trying to get to inbox zero or doing something productive instead.
Yeah, I don't spend too much time on my phone unless it's for productivity reasons. But the one that kind of pulls me back is the New York Times crossword puzzle app.
Oh, wow. Like, I didn't even know that
one. Yeah, I didn't know it existed either. And then I was with one of my best friends, and she kept she was like playing it on the subway, and she's like, "Hey, let's do this thing together." And I was like, "Oh my god, this is really addictive." So it's the kind of thing where like I don't go for it, but once I start it, it's really hard to stop.
Oh, okay. Well, you will find me on the app shortly after this.
There you go.
Just to round up, where can folks who are listening and want to find out more about you or Code Newbie or Codeland go to find that out?
Yeah, great question. So we have our website, codelandconf.com, to hear all about our conference. Tickets are going up June 22nd. So hopefully if you're interested in joining, you'll be able to get your tickets in time for that. And that's happening on July 22nd in New York City. For all other things Code Newbie related, you can go to codenewbie.org. And you can also just follow me on Twitter. It's my first and last name, so Saran Yitbarek. And I usually like post and retweet all the things I'm working on. So you can follow me there.
Thanks so much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, share the podcast with your friends on Twitter and tag a guest you'd like to hear in a future episode. See you soon.